This is The Forgetting.
I was very melancholy about my first grandchild because I just feared that the first grandchild will really never know who I am in the real sense. I don't want anyone's freaking pity. I want their understanding of this disease. I want the fight in the heart so we can get more money, appropriations from the Congress to find a cure. And I want all of us to stand together. You know, Alzheimer's, now you got me going here. So I go back to the table where my wife and all these people are sitting, and I said to my wife, who was the woman standing behind me? The woman on the stage, she was very supportive, encouraging. Who was she? She said, Greg, there was no woman. And I said, yes, there was. There was one woman on the stage, and she was standing behind me. And she said, Greg, there was no woman. And I asked everyone in that around me, and they said, Greg, there was no one there.
From WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and Argo Studios on West 26th Street in New York City, this is The Forgetting, a podcast about dementia. I'm David Shank, author of the book The Forgetting, and senior advisor to an international research consortium called Cure Alzheimer's Fund, which helps make this podcast possible. And with me, as always, is my friend and co-host, Greg O'Brien, author of On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. His book has that subtitle because Greg has early onset Alzheimer's disease, and he is committed to reporting his experience for as long as he possibly can. That's why this podcast exists. Greg, it's great to talk to you again.
David, it's always a pleasure, my friend.
And I think we're going to start doing this more regularly pretty soon. So
long as you don't forget.
We'll try to have someone somewhere remember.
Okay, I have pills if you need them.
All right, thanks. Oh, that's very generous of you.
You know, you and I push each other around, but I've found in this disease as the progressions continue that if you can't have a sense of humor, and you can't laugh at an enemy, the enemy owns you, and I'm not going to let this enemy will take me over as it did my mother and my grandfather and father and uncle, all who died of Alzheimer's. But, you know, while I can, I'm going to laugh in its face. And I urge others, whatever they're dealing with, and I have cancer too, whether it's cancer or ALS or AIDS or whatever the attack is, to look your demon down and laugh. And don't be intimidated.
How are you feeling physically? And you know, tell me just what you're going through, you know, in this kind of immediate time period.
Well, you know, I notice more and more, you know, that's why maybe my sense of humor is ratcheting up, not recognizing people. I mean, if I'm the average person, if I see them out of a setting where I'm used to seeing them, I don't recognize them anymore. And what is so cool about, no, that's the wrong word, but you could find the right words for me. I'd be like the puppet you just, or ventriloquist, you put the words in my mouth, David. But what is good is because we're starting as a country to talk about this, people understand and they're coming up and reintroducing themselves to me, people I've known for 20 years. And that's so cool because I feel that I can talk to them. If I don't sense as a reporter, I was blessed with understanding body language and learning to ask questions. I will probably try to work through not knowing who they are so it doesn't embarrass them. But the other people that come up, I give them a hug and I give them a kiss and I say thank you.
And do you try to fake your way through an instance where you don't recognize someone, or do you just say flat out, I know that I know you, but I don't know who you are?
Right now, and I never did this before, and in the disease I'm more comfortable with it, I pretty much now, 80% of the time, unless I think, no, someone doesn't care, but 80% of the time I say, look, I'm really sorry, but I don't recognize you, and I'm just dealing with some stuff, and I hope that's okay with you. And what I found is good because I know what's happening across the country, and it's part of the maybe dementia friendly, is that the word that we're trying to do with cities and towns. They look at me and they give me a hug, man or woman, and they say, "I'm so and so. How you doing, Greg?" And it's the beginning of a conversation, but it's happening more and more. The rage is ever increasing. It's scaring my wife a lot, who sees it, and my son Connor. My wife the other day, I really got her. She started yelling at me, saying, "Let us try to help you." And you know, that kind of talked me off the ledge a little bit. But what happens is when the synapse or whatever it's called is not connecting, if God gives you a good brain and you try to use it, I try to, and David, you could explain this more, try to find what they call new pathways. So I'll try to bounce something in my brain off this thing. But it's just so damn frustrating that you yell and scream, and it's almost like a Tourette's. And I started doing research about rage and rage and Alzheimer's, and there's a name for it, but I forgot it. But I don't know, David, maybe you want to jump in on the rage part of it.
But while we're still on faces, Greg, can I just ask you kind of in a technical way, have you had the experience yet where you at least momentarily don't recognize one of your close family members, and you have to kind of
my wife on a couple of occasions, other family members. Another thing that's happening, and I think people in Alzheimer's would recognize this, or caregivers, remember the film, and I wrote this, you told me I can't open my laptop, but I could take notes, so I wrote this down. Face Off, was that the movie where there were different faces? I will sometimes look at someone and my brain, and it's happened for a long time, but more and more now, will put a different face on that person because my mind thinks it's someone else. And I'll go up and start to chat them up and then say, "Oh my God, it's not who I, doesn't even look who I thought it was." But in the moment, I thought it was Tom Smith. And it's not Tom Smith. It's someone else. And sometimes that's a little embarrassing.
Right, right. I want to explain to the audience that I did ask you not to have your laptop open for this session, but I want to explain why. It's,
and you have a marshal here who's making sure that I don't. He wants to take it away, and he's a great guy, Mr. Cochran.
I mean, I'm of course not opposed to you opening it and checking something. It's not, this is not a military police situation, but there was a method to that request, that mad request, which is that on the radio, I don't want people to you've been using your laptop in your life, in your non-radio life, as a fantastic crutch, and I mean that in a good way. Right. You're a great note taker, and you have phrases and names and stories, and it's also just, I know it's also kind of a little bit of an emotional, you know, security blanket there, which is also great. But what I want people listening to us to experience, I want them to hear how your brain is working, and I don't want them to be confused if you're saying something extraordinarily eloquent, which you often do and already have in the show. I want them to know that that's coming from you, and not kind of wonder whether or not you're reading off a prompt or prompter or something like that. So yeah. That's the idea. But of course, if you need to open it up and check something, I'm not.
This is not an open book test, so I get that part now. I still want a gentleman C on this, if I could pull that off.
I'll let you know your grade in 6 months. How's that?
Okay, good, good.
So let's talk about your... I know that you're still healthy enough and robust enough and energetic enough to do a lot of traveling. And in fact, you just went overseas. I believe you went to Switzerland for an Alzheimer's conference.
Yeah, I don't travel alone, and I don't drive alone. My son Connor, by the way, drove me down here today, so no one can worry that take their kids off the street that I'll be driving home. So, but I was asked to through Us Against Alzheimer's and a global conference to which I was so honored to speak a couple weeks ago in Switzerland, just about the disease, and they had some of the top healthcare people around the world, and I spoke, and then I was on a panel with people from India and Nigeria and, you know, countries I can't even spell. It was just awesome. You know, in the moment I was okay because I had my speech and delivered, and they do let me open my laptop there, which I'm just telling you, I'm just saying.
They're nicer than I am.
I know, but they let me open the laptop. But we stayed on Lake Geneva, and for the first time I had more serious disconnects. I got lost in the hotel 4 or 5 times and no one could find me. One night I got up in the middle of the night and thought I had to give a speech, walked out of the room, down the hall. No one knew where I was. And finally my son, because I was with my wife, Mary Catherine, and son Connor, had to come find me. And I was sitting in a hallway just up with my laptop up against a wall, not knowing what was going on and where I was. And then I got into a big fight because I said, I have to give a speech. I don't know where it is. I mean, it was wide awake. And so there were a bunch of these disconnects, which was kind of wrenching for the family. I have two other, Brendan and Colleen, but they weren't with me. And they were very upset because they saw some things that they haven't seen before, or at least getting worse. And then there was a time, which I think this is funny, so you get part, you have to laugh at it. So after all this, I was done. I went into rage a lot of times during the thing. But on cue on my speech, I could do that for short periods of time. So we're going to go to downtown Geneva and get a bus. So the bus wasn't where it was supposed to be. So all of a sudden, I went freaking crazy. And then I'm asking people for directions, and I'm getting angry because they don't speak English. Well, hey, Greg, idiot, you're in a foreign country. And I'm driving, you know, Mary Catherine and Connor nuts, and they're just shaking their heads. And so all of a sudden, they're really nervous. I stormed ahead of them by myself in full rage. And then I found the bus. I hop on the bus, and Connor and Mary Catherine show up, and I'm sitting inside the bus, and the bus door closes. They're on the outside.
Oh, my goodness.
And they're going, oh, my God, this freaking idiot is going downtown Geneva. And Connor looks at Mary Catherine, and later they told me they both thought, you know what, maybe that's not so bad. We'll get a little break from them. And they both conceded that they said, like I was a 2-year-old, you know, maybe we'll get he's resourceful. He's not going to die. Something will happen, and maybe that's not so bad. And then Connor thought otherwise and squished Mary. You know what? Those buses squished my wife's face through the door of the bus until it opened, and then they got in. So they told me that I was on probation.
That it's interesting that you said, you know, like a 2-year-old, because that the instant image in my mind is this famous story in my wife's family, where when she was very young, she was with her dad at his office building, and they got in the elevator. There were a bunch of people, and one thing led to another, and the door closed, and she was on the inside of the elevator, and he was still on the outside.
Yeah.
And she took a little trip by herself somewhere, you know, which I think any parent can relate to, and it's of course not coincidental.
Well, it was like we're losing the infant, so where's he going now? What's he going to do? You know,
well,
I was still so much rage, I didn't really care. But then after a while, I said, well, geez, maybe they're not going to get in here. And then I'm going, what a smart guy, what do you do now?
Well, so, you know how to ask questions and ask for help. You're still so verbal that you'd wind up in a safe place somehow.
Well, maybe I'd be raised by gypsies or wolves or something. I don't know what would have happened.
Maybe I'd have to come out to Switzerland and this podcast from there.
From there.
So terrible.
So that was quite an experience, but we all got through it.
Would you say that there was some enjoyment in this trip, or was it just so exhausting and taxing that?
No, there was enjoyment, but it was taxing. I talked to some people when I was there, and I keep asking the question, I'm sure as my mother did, at some point, because she was, I'm on the same track as her, where she fought it and fought it and fought it, and she was blessed with a good brain, and she would laugh at the demons until they took the sledgehammer to her. And you know, among the kind of the first times, I'm wondering how much time is left here, because there were symptoms that I couldn't control. I was asked several months ago, and it was an honor, through the Alzheimer's Association to speak at their, to 1,000 Hollywood A-listers at their annual, it's called A Night of Sardis at the Beverly Hilton. And they had all the top A-listers in the world, Oscar, Emmy Award actors. And I was one of the keynote speakers. And I had prepared remarks, but, you know, I've spoken to, you know, five, six, seven, you know, I speak to a lot of people, several hundreds of people, but not to an audience like this. And before I got on stage, I looked out and I said, they held this where they hold the Golden Globe Awards. And I said, you know, not a lot of people stand in these shoes. It's a little intimidating. And instinctively, I said, because I was really scared, I said, Mom, my mother who died of Alzheimer's, I said, Mom, this is for you. I'm doing it for you. Talk about that place of the heart, as I just talked a little while ago. I heard back in my heart, Greg, you rock this. You just rock this. It was very plain. It was in the way my mother would say it. And I went out because I had this speech written, and guess what, David? I rocked it. And as I was speaking, I noticed there was a woman standing behind me in a very supportive, encouraging role. I wanted to see who it was, and my brain just said, stay focused, stay focused, stay focused. And so when I was through with the speech, and you get to the part of the speech where you're just thanking people, 1,000 people in the audience, all the Hollywood people, stood up and gave me a standing ovation. And I started crying. I was just, wow. And as I turned around to walk up the stage, I wanted to thank the woman behind me. She wasn't there. So I go back to the table where my wife and all these people were sitting. And I said to my wife, who was the woman standing behind me? The woman on the stage, she was very supportive, encouraging. Who was she? My wife said, what? I said, who was the woman standing behind me? She said, Greg, there was no woman. And I said, yes, there was. There was one woman on the stage, and she was standing behind me. And she said, Greg, there was no woman. And I asked everyone in that around me, and they said, Greg, there was no one there. That was your mother. And I believe my mother was on stage with me that night in spirit.
Wow.
I don't know how to explain it, David, but I'm just saying, in this fight, it's medical, it's about medication, it's about the fight an individual, and there's a spiritual element. However anyone wants to find that, that's up to them, but I believe it's all part of the fight.
Well, I guess I would just say two things. One is, whatever you're experiencing is completely real to you, and even to the point of where you're now saying you imagine this woman behind you, or however way you would put it, but
right,
you know that she wasn't there to the other people, but she was there for you.
You know,
it was as real as anything to you. And this is something that all caregivers have to learn, because it's not instinctive as a human being. We are raised to tell the truth and to correct our own mistakes, and if someone says something wrong, to politely correct their mistakes. You know, we live in a truth and fact-based society for the most part. At least we tell ourselves that we do. But in the world of dementia, it actually becomes obvious to every caregiver eventually that there's not only no point in correcting this alternate reality that the person with dementia is experiencing, but you need to realize that is their reality, that you need to respect their own reality and embrace it. And so you end up acknowledging things that you, the caregiver yourself, don't see or experience, but you know that they're real to that person. And so there's a transitionary period there for the caregiver where it feels like they are lying or fibbing or coddling
misperceiving
or something.
Or anything, yeah.
Yeah, well, they're just not. It feels, it goes against the grain of how they were raised, but then they they realize intellectually it's the right thing to do, and then over time it starts to feel more and more like the correct way to behave is to kind of accept this alternate reality as this patient is experiencing it.
I mean, my only advice to caregivers is that love is not a pill that you can take. You feel it and you embrace it, and it gets explained and sensed in different ways.
I want to go back to the hotel in Switzerland, if I can, because I want to ask if you recall this. You said that you were getting lost in the hotel, or you got lost one time, or maybe more. And if you can remember what that experience was like, whether you want to talk about it emotionally or how you got lost and what that felt like, and then how that event ended. Did someone find you? Did you snap back into a recognition of where you were?
It was fear. I got into an elevator and thought I was going down to the lobby, and I ended on this floor where there wasn't anyone there. And then I got afraid of, because my mind was telling me, don't go back into the elevator. You have no idea where you I said, well, maybe I'm going to take an elevator to hell. That's just how your mind works. And so I started walking down the stairs. And this disease, there's a paranoia in the disease, and it builds up and it builds up, and your brain starts telling you stuff. So finally I said, okay, I'm going to walk to hell. I'm going to walk to the bottom floor and see what the hell is down there. And then there were no more stairs. So I said, well, wherever I am, I'm at the bottom. And aren't we all at times at the bottom? And there was a path, a hallway, and I followed it out, and there were a bunch of doors, and finally I opened one of the doors, and it led to the lobby. And then I just took a deep breath, but I was shaken. And then I got back to the room, and I was angry. I was angry at my wife for me getting lost, you know. And then they're mad at me. They're going, you can't go anywhere. And I go, what do you mean? You know, it's like, remember when you're a little kid and they put those harnesses on you? I had one of those emotional harnesses on me, and you know, it was just like, oh man, this sucks. But I was scared.
To state the obvious, had you just gotten back in the elevator and not panicked, I know that's a big if, but
yeah.
You knew where you were going if you'd gotten back in and looked at the numbers and the board and said,
what happens, and again, I cut up a frog in high school, but the synapse, you know, you're not thinking the way you should be thinking. It's not connecting. If I could switch a metaphor, I just had my first grandchild, and the same kind of thing happened if I explain it. First of all, and I didn't tell anyone about this, but I was very melancholy about my first grandchild because I just feared that the first grandchild will really never know who I am in the real sense. And that was sad for me. But it was overcome with joy when this baby girl, Colleen's daughter, Adeline, sweet Adeline, an old Irish name, was born 8 ounces, 8 pounds, 8 ounces. But because of the Switzerland trip, my wife went down for the birth, but I was told I didn't need to go because everyone thought that might be a little bit of a problem because I'd be out of sorts. So I was on lockdown with my son, Connor, under house arrest at home. So my daughter calls at midnight. My wife is heading to Baltimore the next day and says, Daddy, my water broke. So I said, wow. So I didn't want to wake my wife up because she was getting up early. But so I started texting her. I didn't sleep all night. Then the next day, my wife is down there and she says, we're in the hospital and we're going to start pushing at 2 o'clock. So I'm saying, what's pushing mean? You know, and then I realize you have to push the baby out. It doesn't swim out. So I'm thinking, okay, well, this is going to happen, forgetting how long it took. I have 3 kids. It takes a long time for the baby to push out. At 4 o'clock, nothing's happened. So now my mind, just like it was, and I'm just trying to explain to people, and that's what I try to do in layman's terms, what it's like. Now my mind is taking over and telling me stuff that just isn't true. And I'm saying, there's something wrong. I haven't heard back. There's something wrong. So I'm texting my wife. What's going on? There's something wrong. my wife texts back, "That's all I know." I text back, "Bullshit." And she says, "Calm down." And I said, "Bullshit, what's wrong?" And so then I wait till 6 o'clock, and now I'm in a panic. My mind, paranoia is part of this disease. I pick up the phone and basically say, "I'm on my way to the airport. I'm coming down. I'm going to talk to the doctors, and I'm going to find out what's going on because everyone's lying to me."
Yeah, that would have turned out real well.
Yeah, I know. So the next thing, the family has this confab, all my brothers and sisters, the phone lines are ringing. How do we get this clown off the ledge? And my sister, Maureen, God bless her, who's a baby nurse, she's done deliveries, she called me and said, "You stay the freak home. Everything is okay." She said, "I know you know about Alzheimer's, but you don't know about babies. So I'm just telling you, you stick to Alzheimer's and I'll stick to the babies and you stay the freak home." She had to raise her voice to me. "You got that?" And I said, "Okay." She's my older sister. So I went to the gym because I had to work something out. When I was on the treadmill, I was with Connor, my son, and he shows me this text, and I can't read it because I have my glasses on. And I said, "What?" And Connor says, "Your grandfather." And I started crying. So that's how the story ended. But I don't know if any of this makes sense. But I'm trying to give listeners a sense, kind of up front, what it's like, and maybe it's similar stuff for others.
And how is she doing? How's the baby doing?
Oh, she's speaking 6 languages now, in my mind. And she's trying out for the Olympics. But
so you can imagine the good stuff, too. You're not just imagining the dark stuff.
Well, the good stuff now after the baby. No, she's cute. She's gorgeous. So I'm being allowed to go down and see her for Christmas. But yeah, I think after they have Adeline in counseling, I'll be allowed to see her. So, you know, I'm a baby boomer, and a lot of people who are listening to this or baby boomers, and we first played by the rules, and then we broke the rules, and then we made new rules, and then we went off and had babies and got married, not necessarily in that order, and became part of the establishment. And now a lot of us, and I would encourage more and more as we get to the final laps in life, and we're looking at that, whether someone is dealing with a cancer or Alzheimer's or AIDS, ALS. There's this sense, I think, among the generation that maybe we could do some more good on the way out. You know, if you don't have a purpose in life, if you don't have, there's a wonderful, in the Old Testament, in Proverbs, it says, "Without a vision, the people perish." If you don't have something to get up every day for and a vision, then I think your life is less meaningful. So don't feel bad.
Amen
for me.
Amen to that.
I don't want anyone's freaking pity. I want their understanding of this disease. I want the fight in the heart so we can get more money, appropriations from the Congress to find a cure. And I want all of us to stand together. You know, Alzheimer's, now you got me going here, but you know, it's a disease that doesn't know gender, it doesn't know color, it doesn't know sexual preference. It's a disease that hits all of us. And I think one word to use before, as I said before, is love. You know, in Alzheimer's, you come to understand the most meaningful thing left in your life is love, and I think you become less judgmental. And I don't want to suggest that people in the country emulate Alzheimer's, but there is a freeing in Alzheimer's in a loss of judgment and in love that can be a blessing.
You're a poet, and sometimes you know it.
I didn't open my laptop, right? Getting shakes, so. But I have my. I had some notes here, so just. You
know. Let me say my formal goodbyes here. So that's it for our show today. Greg and I want to thank our colleagues at Cure Alzheimer's Fund, especially the chair of its research consortium, Dr. Rudy Tanzi,
my hero,
who our hero, who in addition to doing all this great research, actually composed our theme music. Paul Ruest is our engineer here at Argo Studios in New York City at WCAI in Woods Hole. The engineer is Dan Treidel. The Forgetting is a production of WCAI. Our producer is the great Sean Corcoran. And Greg, you know you still owe me $100.
I know. I'm going to fax it to you.